So, Dr. Sean Centers, thank you for joining me today. I appreciate you taking the time for an interview here.
Sure.
I'm going to read a little bit of your bio here. You're the medical director of the Osteopathic Center for Children. You're a pediatrician specializing in integrative medicine and osteopathic pediatrics. Let's see, you are the founding president of the American Academy of Pediatric Osteopathy. You are also have been named one of the top pediatricians in San Diego County, California, and California. Say it again. You've been named one of the top pediatricians in San Diego County, California, by the International Association of Pediatricians, and you're a distinguished fellow of the American Pediatrics Council. I mean, I can keep reading. You got quite an impressive bio. Mm-hmm. So, again, thank you for taking the time to join us today. I want to get your perspective as a pediatrician. And you're also you provide the CME for the Autism One here. We're
yes.
Autism One in Chicago, and you are the CME director. Is that correct?
I am.
Okay. So I want to get your perspective as a pediatrician on vaccines. This interview will be part of what we call the truth about vaccines. So I would like to know from you, let me ask you a very, very general question. What's the truth about vaccines?
Well, I think that you have to make a differentiation between vaccination and immunization.
Okay.
So vaccination is a procedure which we put foreign particles into the body and expect the immune system to create an immunity against those foreign particles. But the question is are we doing that at an age and at a time where the body can actually do that? And there have been a number of studies that show that children younger than 12 months, the immune system has a really difficult time dealing with those possibilities. The second thing is that when you put multiple components into the body, there's no scientific research or even evidence base that shows what these vaccines do together, the polypharmacy as it's called. And so there are concerns. Now, in my practice, I strongly believe that the parents have the right to choose. There's no question that there are different opinions or different sides on the vaccine issue. And in fact, in my opinion, we don't really know what the truth is. We don't know absolutely that these vaccines are safe. And we don't, however, we do know some of the vaccines are not as effective as they used to be. And so then we have to weigh those choices. So there's no question that it seems in times past these vaccines, these medical interventions have helped to possibly decrease the amount of infection. Likely they've saved lives. But we are dealing with the 21st century, 2016, and the question is, do the risks outweigh, you know, the benefits and vice versa? And for some children, there is a great risk. And the real problem, the real issue is that we don't know which children those are.
Mm.
And because we don't know, we are exposing those most vulnerable, most at-risk children to these immunological agents.
Mm. So, in other words, Dr. Centers, it's almost as if, to a certain extent, that vaccines are an experiment on the children because we don't know what they're going to do.
Well, the problem is that there's so many of them. You know, if you're talking about the vaccines from 20 years ago, you know, we have data, but if you're talking about the most recent ones, you know, there's not long-term data as to what the outcomes are. And we know that in the past, there have been problems. This is not something that the people who are so pro-vaccine or advocate for vaccines are not unaware of. Take something like the polio virus. The oral polio has had a number of issues. When I was a resident back in the late 1990s, we still gave an oral polio vaccine, which is you took a little liquid, you swallowed it. But because that was a live virus, every year there were hundreds of children who were actually getting polio.
From the oral vaccine.
And so around 99, 2000, they made the decision, because of this, to stop giving the oral polio. And they now have an inactivated form, which obviously is safer. But then there's also a question of even whether this vaccine is effective. There are three types of wild polio, 1, 2, and 3. And type 1 and 3 was highly protective with the oral polio vaccine. But type 2, with the inactivated polio, which is what we use now, it's not very effective. So you have hundreds of thousands, millions of parents who think that their child is protected from polio because they have this inactivated polio vaccine, but in fact that may not be the case. And so there is a potential for a widespread polio infection because they've changed the vaccine itself. The polio vaccine also had another problem, and that problem was that they make the polio vaccine from passing the virus back and forth between monkey kidney cells. So they use the kidney cells like a filter. And there was a concept in medicine back in the 40s and 50s that if you have a virus that affects, for example, an animal, it can't affect a human. So that was the prevailing concept or theory. What they did not know was that this really isn't true. And so I'm sure that you are you're probably aware of the problems that that created, right? So there is a virus called simian virus 40, SV40. And they have found that virus in the center of many types of cancer. So that would include breast cancer, that would include a number of different types of cancer. That SV40, simian, it means monkey. And that SV40 came from these monkey kidney cells that they were passing this virus through to make the vaccine. So millions of people were exposed to this virus that they didn't even know would affect humans. And many years later, they find it in the tissue of people with cancer.
There's an example of a vaccine that was not only not safe and effective, but it actually was extremely damaging to the recipients, potentially causing cancer.
Potentially causing cancer, and that's the prevailing thought.
Yeah.
And the polio vaccine has had a number of problems, and it's, I would say, one of the safer vaccines. In the very beginning, there was a pharmaceutical company actually centered in California near San Diego who actually sent out large doses, I think we're about 100,000 doses, of the Sabin vaccine, which had a live virus in it that wasn't attenuated, wasn't weakened. And so there were something like 50, 60,000 kids that got polio because they were given the vaccine.
They were given the vaccine without a weakened virus.
Yes, so this was back in the 50s, And what happened with that is that initially the company denied any problem, even though they knew that there was a problem. The American Academy of Pediatrics, even though they knew that there was a big problem with this vaccine, they did not pursue it until eventually there was such a massive outbreak of polio that they had to admit that this was indeed a problem, and they stopped the company from producing it. This same company, and I'm blanking out on the name of the company at this moment, but this same company 25 years later, did the exact same thing with blood products that they were producing for hemophiliac children.
It was Bayer. Factor VIII, wasn't it?
Bayer owns that company, but that's not the name of the company. Okay. It's like...
Because you're talking about Factor VIII, which was a hemophiliac product. It was contaminated with HIV, correct?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, so back in the 80s, the same company that did this thing back in the 50s did the exact same thing. They had a blood product that was given to hemophiliacs, Factor VIII, and it was contaminated with HIV. And people started saying, hey, something's going on here. My patients are developing HIV. And again, they were ignored. And eventually, it was proven that, in fact, it was contaminated. And so what did the pharmaceutical company do?
They should have destroyed it. They just destroyed the batches.
Absolutely not. They sold it to Africa. And now you have this introduction of hundreds of thousands of doses of this product into Africa. And they knew absolutely that it was contaminated. And they gave these children and adult hemophiliacs HIV. That's unconscionable.
It is unconscionable. I mean, how can we even begin to explain the reasoning that would go behind a decision like that?
Yeah, it's finances.
It's all money, isn't it?
It's finances.
Mm-hmm. They didn't want to lose the money on the hundreds of thousands of doses, so they shipped it somewhere else where they didn't know.
And we're not regulated by the U.S. federal government.
Wow. So, you know, Dr. Simpson, you mentioned the outbreak of polio that was directly related to the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with other outbreaks that have been caused by vaccines?
You know, I think that that's a complicated issue because we don't have access to all the data. The pharmaceutical companies and the Centers for Disease Control and the federal government keep that data very closely within their system. So even the VAERS, V-A-E-R-S database, which is for reactions or complaints that happen as a result of vaccinations, they're not open to us. So yes, there are thoughts that this is happening, but we don't have clear data.
Got it. As a pediatrician, I mean, I'm sure that you have seen vaccine-damaged children.
So I'm an integrative pediatrician and osteopath, and we see many, many vaccine-injured children. Because the question is, and is another question that the mainstream medicine hasn't really addressed, and that is, what do you do with these children who are vaccine-injured? What treatments are available? Well, there is no treatments available from the mainstream Western medicine. The approach that we have in integrated pediatrics and osteopathic pediatrics, there are techniques that we have that can aid these children that have been damaged. Many of these side effects that occur from the vaccine injury have to do with swelling and then contraction of the tissue within the brain and spinal cord. It's called dura. And it is very similar to a child who has meningitis or some type of meningeal inflammation. And the membranes, the coverings around the brain and the spinal cord, they contract. And osteopaths can actually feel that with their hands. Mm. And you know immediately when a child comes in and has been vaccine injured. There are things that we can do, but and we can get help some children, but there is a certain portion or part of that damage that is not, in my opinion, repairable.
Okay, so what might it be that causes the swelling and the contraction? Do we have any idea?
Well, it's from the immunologic agents. It's almost like they actually get the disease.
So they're vaccinated and it actually gives them the disease.
It gives them the disease which affects the central nervous system. So, and that's not something that, you know, I'm just coming up with from filling patients' heads or something. It's a well-known side effect. It's encephalitis. So if you go and you look on the manufacturer's label and it says side effect encephalitis or meningitis, that's well-known. Epilepsy, seizures are also a well-known side effect. So the question is, we need to really investigate how to make these vaccines safer and identify those children who would be at highest risk for a reaction.
You know, I agree. We need to determine if any schedule makes sense. I mean, the parents' choice, right? I mean,
absolutely.
You'd agree the parents should be able to decide. But I just interviewed a journalist from Columbia, and down there in 2013, they mandated the Gardasil vaccine. And there was an outbreak. There was like 700 damaged girls shortly thereafter. They took it down there in one small community, 700 girls that suffered damages that were listed on the package insert that it might cause these symptoms, and they got it.
The Gardasil vaccine, although it's highly promoted, it's not in the general requirements in most states. There's a lot of side effects attributed to that particular vaccine, and we've seen a lot of children come in with side effects. First of all, the idea that you give it to a male child is, in my opinion, unsubstantial. There's no evidence that it's going to decrease the number of female human papillomavirus cases. The second issue with the Gardasil is the timing of the vaccine. You know, most women who get cancer related to HPV get cancer in their 60s. So there is a huge question whether this vaccine is even going to be effective. The second question is, and it's kind of the same concept with hepatitis B. The question is, you're vaccinating this large population, and very few people in this population would even be at risk for HPV. So sure, if you're going to be a prostitute, to have many, many sexual partners, yeah, it's probably a good idea to get that. The same thing with the hepatitis B. Hepatitis B is a sexually transmitted disease, or it can be transmitted through blood contact. So if you're going to share needles, or have multiple sexual partners, you know, it probably is a good idea to get it. But that's not the majority of the children in the United States.
Well, yeah. They mandate it in many states on the first day of birth, you get a Hep B vaccine.
So why did they do that? Do you know why they do that?
I have no idea. I mean, I don't know any one-day-olds that are sexually active or that use drugs.
Well, the thing is that there is a concept in Western medicine called epidemiology. And the epidemiological idea is to vaccinate for the most severe condition with the total population. So when you sign up for your child to have a vaccine, that doesn't guarantee that the vaccine is working. And it doesn't guarantee, or it doesn't mean that vaccine is going to work with your individual child. If you read the disclaimer very closely, it says that you are signing up for a vaccine program, and that vaccine program is going to protect, supposedly, the mass population. So you take hepatitis B. Where did hepatitis B come from? Well, they initially did those studies in the Bronx in New York back in the 80s and 90s. At that time, there was this disproven theory that hepatitis B and HIV were related. So one of their primary study groups were teenagers, adolescents, who had become infected with HIV. So the question was this a vaccine, you know, safe and effective. Well, so you have this HIV clinic of teenagers. You know, what teenager is going to sign up for an experimental vaccine? Well, even though they were paying these kids like $100 to get the vaccine. Well, the kids that signed up was just a very small percentage. So when it came to the ACIP meeting, which is the American Academy of Infectious Disease Practices, which makes the decisions on which vaccine needs to be in the schedule, the company had written in their paper the only way to completely protect the children in the Bronx is to vaccinate these children at day one. So they came and they gave them a piece of paper, and the little piece of paper was, you know, yellow highlighted so that they would see day one, and that's how the vaccine schedule came to be. So yeah, you know, if you think that your child is going to, you know, be fooling around with a kid in the next bassinet, you know, you might want to give them the hepatitis B vaccine. But if that's not your child, then, you know, I think you want to be careful in considering these, you know, vaccines. When we look at the children in the Bronx and those children in, you know, the inner cities of our country, they are a population that we should be concerned about. However, that child in the Bronx is not the same as that child in San Diego or in Salt Lake City or in, many of the other places across our country. So every child is not the same. And that's the problem, and that's what I think that the majority of the people who are highly promoting the immunizations really don't realize.
They're not all children are the same. You know, I interviewed an immunologist yesterday, Tatiana, and one of the things she mentioned was that the only case that rubella is even remotely close to dangerous is if a pregnant mother gets rubella. Other than that, rubella, she said, it's never has a bad side effect. So the only...
Absolutely. So rubella is like, it gives you a low-grade fever, maybe 101, a runny nose, lasts for three days, and that's it.
So she said, yeah, for her, the only even remotely plausible group that would need that would be pregnant moms. So that rules
Absolutely.
Out every male. So she said, it is unthinkable that we would be giving an MMR shot, measles, mumps, rubella, to a male, because it's never going to hurt a male. I mean, you might have a runny nose for 3 days. So she said, you know, why don't you break them up and give them separately so that they have more of a chance to recover?
Well, you know, that has to do with marketing, right? So you'd make more money if you're selling three vaccines in one than just two vaccines, right?
Yeah.
So that's marketing and money and things like that. It's not medicine. So the same thing with the MMR. You have a schedule which says 4 to 5 doses, right? So if you do titers, which titers are an analysis of the antibody reaction to the vaccine. So if we do titers on children after the third dose, 75 to 80% of those children have sufficient titers. However, they give a fourth and fifth dose because of a very small percentage that don't develop the titers. So we could test every child for those antibody titers to see if they have developed the response. But we don't. Why? Because it's more money to do the titers than just to give them the vaccines. So who makes money from that? Well, the vaccine company, and that's, of course, who comes up with the recommendations.
Sure. So they're part of a vaccine program for the collective good, right? This herd immunity concept, whatever. It's all part of this collectivism that it doesn't really matter if one child gets hurt because it's for the greater good to have this herd immunity or whatever, unless it's, of course, your child that has, you know, got the MMR and has autism. Sorry about that, but it's still acceptable collateral damage because it's all for the greater good in the way that their thinking goes, correct?
Absolutely. You know, the autism issue is really controversial among the mainstream community of physicians, and I don't think that the vaccines alone are the only issue. You know, it would be really simple to just say all autism is caused by vaccines. I don't necessarily think that that's the case. I think that there are many factors, including vaccines. I think that vaccines and other viruses may be triggers for what we see as we call autism.
Yeah, that's a good point. Just like with cancer, multiple causes. So it's going to be hard to point out any disease that says there's one thing that causes one disease. It's really a collective accumulation of toxicity in many cases, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, in your field of cancer, you know, we don't know what these vaccines are doing as far as development of cancer 20, 30, 40 years from now, because there's no studies being done. The mainstream infectious disease people, and to be somewhat in defense of these people, they're under a lot of pressure, and a lot of it's political, so they're not really allowed to do the studies that they should be doing. So we should be out there identifying who are those children that are going to be affected by these vaccines in a negative way. What can we do to protect them? What, you know, are the standards? We're not doing that because people don't want to come out with a study that says, hey, this vaccine causes autism, because they're scared that, you know, they're going to take all the vaccines away. So that's, you know, that's their concern, and that's their fear, and a lot of this is just kind of a fear-based response. And so they're really not doing the fundamental research that needs to be done.
And apparently they're not doing the fundamental research if you said that we don't know if 20 or 30 years down the road these vaccines are going to cause cancer. So if they're not testing to see if these vaccines cause cancer, then how can we say that they're safe?
So we can't. And the other issue is that these vaccines are what's called a biologic agent. And biologics don't have to have the same rigorous studies as many of the other drugs that we use do. And many of the drugs, even though they go through rigorous studies, still later, once they go out into the mass population, have problems. Vioxx, Premarin,
yeah.
You know, we could list hundreds of drugs like that.
Sure, and with Vioxx, I mean, one of the men that did the studies on it, Dr. Scott Rubin, he later admitted that he falsified research.
Right.
So, you know, do we see a lot of research fraud or kind of cherry picking the results to make it look like vaccines are safe and effective?
Well, you know, I think that's a general problem within all of the medications that we use today. I think that certainly in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s. There was this idea that the majority of the research with drugs, pharmaceuticals, should be going on in the medical schools and should be going on in the universities across our country. And really, up until about the 80s, 90% of all that research was done in medical institutions. Today, it's the exact opposite. 90% of the research is actually done by research firms, companies that are hired by the pharmaceutical industry to develop the research. And so they will hand them, you know, I need a drug that does X, Y, and Z. You do the research, you know, for that. So that's not how research should be done.
It's not really independent.
It's not independent, and it's coming up with your results before you actually do the study.
It's working backwards.
It's absolutely backwards.
Wow.
And that's a serious issue. And it's not an issue that's not unknown among the mainstream Western physicians.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with the research world. I've read a lot of articles and, you know, reputable journals that are now admitting, yeah, there's a lot of fraud going on out here. A lot of, not necessarily always fraud, but just material misstatements of fact.
Right, and unfortunately, you know, a lot of this is driven by the industry, and there's a great amount of financial incentive to do this, and it's really hard to come up with new drugs and new biologics. So they have to spend millions of dollars, and then you spend millions of dollars and you come up with some data that says, oh, it's
doesn't work,
or it has
then
severe...
Then you toss the data and you find somebody that gives you the data that you want so you can sell it.
Because you
have to make a return on the investment. I mean, let's be fair. The pharmaceutical companies are publicly traded. So their job is to make money. So they do what they need to make money. And in another field, maybe that's not so detrimental. If it's maybe, you just got an increase in price on your yard guy that mows your lawn. So he's got to make money, he's got to cover his costs. Not as big of an effect on the world at large, but when you have pharmaceutical companies that are like Vioxx that's been implicated in over, 60,000 deaths, and the whole bottom line was they're trying to make more money, then we have a problem, don't we?
We have a severe problem, and it's affecting every aspect of our lives, and it needs to change.
Mm. I agree, Dr. Sanders, and I appreciate what you do. I appreciate what you've done for Autism One, and really appreciate you taking the time to share with us your input on this vitally important topic today. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.